It was easy to imagine how Eric would react to pulling the trigger on April 20th, but Dylan seemed baffled about his own response. He set Eric in motion on paper, with himself as narrator, to observe. How would murder feel? It felt wonderful. If I could face an emotion of God, it would have looked like the man, he wrote. I not only saw in his face, but also felt emanating from him power, complacence, closure, and godliness. The man smiled, and in that instant, through no endeavor of my own, I understood his actions. The story ended there, not with the murders, but with the impact on the man behind them. Nobody observed Dylan typing the story, but he appears to have spilled it all onto the screen in one great rush. He didn't stop to spell check or fix errors or hit return. It's all run together in a single paragraph that would have filled 5 pages in a normal font. Dylan turned the story in as a creative writing assignment on February 7th. His instructor, Judy Kelly, read it and shuddered. It was an astounding piece of writing for a 17-year-old, but she was deeply disturbed. Dylan wasn't the first kid to write a violent story. Eric had been writing combat scenes about heroic Marines all semester. Eric was obsessed with warfare. He mimed machine gun fire in class all the time. But war stories were different. Dylan's protagonist was killing civilians ruthlessly and enjoying it. Kelly wrote a note at the bottom instructing Dylan to come see her. She wanted to talk to him before assigning a grade. "You are an excellent writer and storyteller, but I have some problems with this one," she wrote. Dylan came to see her. The story was grossly violent and offensive, she said, unacceptable. Submitting the story was probably an intentional leak. Dylan chickened out. "It's just a story," he said. This was creative writing class. He had been creative. "Creative was fine," Kelly said. "But where was all this cruelty coming from? Just reading the thing was unnerving." Dylan maintained it was just a story. Kelly didn't buy it. She called Tom and Sue Klebold and discussed it with them at length. They did not seem too worried, she told police later. They made a comment about how understanding kids could be a real challenge. Even after the murders, one of Dylan's classmates agreed. "It's a creative writing class," she told the Rocky Mountain News. "You write about what you want. Shakespeare wrote all about death." The girl was not a friend of the killers. But Kelly knew she had picked up on something different. She had seen boys captivated by violence. She had read innumerable accounts of murder. She had never been confronted with a story this sadistic. It was not just a question of the events in the story, but the attitude of the author conveying them. Dylan had a gift for bringing a scene to life. He conveyed action, thought, and feeling, a creepy, merciless feeling. Kelly described the story as literary and ghastly, the most vicious story I ever read. Kelly brought it to Dylan's school counselor, Brad Butts. He talked to Dylan, who downplayed it again. "Good enough." Kelly had done the right thing. She'd contacted the 3 people most likely to have other information about Dylan, his guidance counselor and his parents. If the counselor or parents knew Dylan had been setting off pipe bombs and showing them around at Blackjack Pizza, they could have connected fantasy with reality, and NBK might have come to an end. They did not. Jeffco investigators had most of the pieces. Most of the adults close to the killers were in the dark. In his journal, Dylan returned to his love obsession. He wanted to get to godliness, but he had been seeking for 2 horrible years now, and none of his dreams had come true. Eric offered hope. Eric offered the very feelings Dylan was searching for. Eric offered reality. Of all things. Maybe seeking was a sham. Dylan wasn't quite ready to embrace murder. He would fight it almost until the end, but from here on, he was close. He would take the short story with him on April 20th. It was found in Dylan's car, alongside the failed explosives, to be torn to bits in his final act. The car was slated for destruction. so Dylan didn't bring the story for our benefit. Perhaps he needed a little courage that day. Perhaps he wanted to read it one last time. It was time for target practice. They picked a beautiful spot. The place was called Rampart Range, a winding network of unpaved roads through rugged national forest in the Rockies, not too far from Dylan's house. For their first extended gunplay, they picked an area set aside for dirt bikers and joyriding on ATVs. An off-roading website urged readers to experience the vistas slowly. Let your imagination run wild as the boulders take on ever-changing faces. Three friends went with them on March 6th, Mark Maines and Phil Duran, who had teamed up to get Dylan the Tech 9, and Mark's girlfriend Jessica. They brought the guns acquired for the attack, and their friends had a couple more. They packed bowling pins stolen from Bellevue Lanes to use as targets, and they took a camcorder. It was important to document historic events. It was cold up there, still plenty of snow on the ground. They dressed sensibly, in layers. Eric and Dylan started with their trench coats on, but worked up a sweat and shed them. They had ear protection and eye gear. Some of the time, they wore it. They shot a bowling pin full of lead, and then Eric had another idea. He aimed his shotgun at an imposing pine 5 feet away. He missed. And it hurt. The gun had a vicious recoil, which his arm had to absorb. Every inch you cut a shotgun back magnifies the kick. Eric and Dylan had cut theirs back ridiculously short, almost to the chamber, and now they were going to pay. He directed Dylan to follow. "Try to hit a tree," he said. "I want to see what a slug does to the tree." Dylan punched a 2-inch-wide hole in the trunk. They rushed forward to inspect the damage. Eric dug his finger around and produced a pellet. "That's a fucking slug," Dylan squealed. Eric's voice was subdued. "Imagine that in someone's fucking brain." "It hurt my wrist, the son of a bitch," Dylan said. "I bet so." Dylan was laughing now. "Look at that. I've got blood now." He loved it. Eric kept working the human metaphor. He picked up a bowling pin with a small hole drilled through the front and a crater out the back. He showed off each side to the camera. "Entry wound, exit wound." His buddy laughed, but he didn't understand. He got the little joke, missed the big one. The battle was already underway around him. Eric loved foreshadowing. Everyone there was implicated. Only two could see. Most of the time, they worked methodically to improve their skills. One kid would fire while another stood beside him, calling out results to make real-time adjustments. High to the right, low to the left, left again. Single-barrel shotguns require a reload every round, and that would seriously impact the body count. Eric prepared by drilling himself in a rapid shoot-and-load technique. Every shot was punishing. The blast would tear the barrel out of his left hand and whip his gun arm back like a rubber band. But he learned quickly. Soon, he was riding out the recoil to catch the barrel stub as it swung around, snap it open, beat a shell, lock it down, squeeze around, and repeat the process in one fluid, continuous motion. He pounded out 4 shots in 5 seconds. He was pleased. It had all been theoretical up to that point. How much damage could they really do with that gun? They had their answer now. Eric was a killing machine. Eric and Dylan approached the camera to show off their war wounds, large patches of skin scraped off between thumb and forefinger, where they needed to work on tightening their grip. "When high school kids use guns," somebody said. Everybody laughed. Maines tried Eric's gun and winced at that hand grip. "You should round that out," he advised. "Yeah," Eric said. "I'm going to work on that." They fired more and showed the wounds again, bloodier, more severe. "Guns are bad," Maines said. "When you saw them off and make them illegal, bad things happen to you." That got more laughs. "Just say no to sawed-off shotguns." They were on a roll now. Eric grabbed hold of his gun barrel and mugged for the camera. He spanked the firing assembly several times. "Bad." Dylan waved his index finger at it. "No, no, no." Dr. Fusilier watched the Rampart video a few days after the massacre. It showed the final progression from fantasy to fact. It had been a 2-year evolution from frivolous prankster missions to a series of escalating thefts. Eric was turning into a professional criminal. He had crossed the mental hurdle from imagining crimes to committing them. This was how it would feel. The boys continued training. They made 3 target practice trips with Mains. Dylan leaked again. He had been excited about his weapons, and sometime in February, he told Zach he had gotten something really cool. Like what? Something in Desperado, Dylan said, a violent film they thought Quentin Tarantino directed. Zach confronted him. It was a gun, wasn't it? Yeah, a double-barreled shotgun, Dylan said, just like the piece in Desperado. Eric had gotten one too, and they had fired them. Freaking wild. They never spoke about it again, Zach told the FBI later. 49. Ready to be done. Mr. Dean knew the date his mission would wrap, May 18, 2002. He had one objective after the massacre, to shepherd nearly 2,000 kids to emotional high ground. The last class of freshmen would graduate that May. Frank had no idea what he might do afterward. He could not plan yet. His hands were full. He had 3 school years to get through. He had seriously underestimated the turmoil of the first. Nobody had foreseen that torrent of aftershocks. He would not make that mistake again. The second summer offered a respite, just like the first, but when the doors reopened in August 2000, the faculty braced for the next onslaught. It never came. There was never a year like that first one, never anything close. The second school year got off on a high note. An addition had been constructed over the summer with a new library. The old one was demolished, converting the commons into a 2-story atrium. Most of the parents' group attended the opening. Sue Patrone glowed. For the past 16 months, she had felt physically weak every time she'd stepped inside the school. "Like you're underwater and can't breathe," she'd said. All that was lifted away. She had been fighting for more than a year, and she was done. Nearly all the parents were. Sue's ex-husband was the exception. Brian Rohrbaugh and Frank DeAngelis dominated the ceremony, standing 30 feet apart in the cafeteria with a cluster of reporters around each, talking about each other. Mr. D was diplomatic and tried to avoid the feud altogether. But reporters kept shuttling over from Rohrbaugh with fresh accusations for Mr. D to respond to. Brian was brutal and direct. "The school caused these murders," he said. "The administration must pay." Mr. D developed a heart condition. It appeared the first autumn after the shootings. Stress, the doctors said. No kidding. Frank was riddled with symptoms of PTSD, numbness, anxiety attacks, inability to concentrate, and reclusiveness. Therapy helped him sort them out. Immediately after the murders, he had trouble making eye contact. It got worse. What was that about? Guilt, he discovered. I had never heard of survivor guilt. I felt guilty that Dave and the kids died, and I lived. His wife wanted to help. It was eating him up, but he couldn't express it to her. He was just like his students. "Don't shut your parents out," he begged them. He could cry in front of them, but his wife, she didn't understand, and he didn't particularly want her to. He just wanted solace at home. The years after the tragedy were tumultuous. He got to Columbine at 6 a.m., left at 8 or 9 in the evening. Weekends, he came in for shorter stints, quiet time, to catch up. At any given time, he had a dozen kids on suicide watch. Breakdowns were a daily occurrence among the students and the staff. He got tremendous satisfaction out of helping the kids, but it was a terrible drain. He had a couple of hours every night to forget it all. "I needed that time to regenerate," he said. "The last thing I wanted to do when I got home was talk about it." His wife implored him to open up. His son and daughter were concerned. His parents and siblings seemed to call constantly, "Are you eating? Should you be driving?" "I think I know when to eat," he would say. Everyone had to know how he was feeling. "How are you doing? How are you doing?" "Enough," he would say. "Please stop." Mr. D struggled with some of the staff, too. A therapist complained that she spent years in his school after the tragedy, and he never learned her name. He could name all 2,000 students. He had a strong team of administrators who were great at heading off problems, but some of them needed support themselves. One was brilliant, but chatty. She had to talk out all her pain. Frank wouldn't do it. He confessed to his staff that he knew he wasn't there for them. He just didn't have the juice. He had so much in him, and it was all going to the kids. It got the kids through. Frank sought out avenues for relaxation. He joined a Sunday night bowling league with his wife. Strangers would approach every frame. "How are you doing? How are the students?" Once again, it was Columbine, he said. Out to dinner? Same thing. People would come right up to the booth. It got to the point where I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to stay home. Home was just as bad. "I would go down to my basement to avoid my wife and kids," he said. His golden retriever followed. That was nice. His family resented him. "They could not understand why I was acting that way," he said. He felt awful, too. "I wasn't the person I wanted to be." He started counseling immediately after the attack, and he credits it with saving him. If he could do one thing over, it would be to include his family in the therapy. "They had no idea what PTSD was," he said. "If they had just understood what I was going through, it would have been all right." His marriage didn't make it. Early in 2002, he and his wife agreed to divorce. He said Columbine had not been the sole reason, but it was a big part. As he prepared to move out, Frank came upon 4,000 letters he'd received in 1999. Most were supportive, some angry. A few threatened his life. He had tried to read 25 a day. That proved traumatic. Now he was ready to face them. He read through a big stack, and one name caught him off guard. Diane Meyer had been his old high school sweetheart. They had broken up before graduation and lost touch for 30 years. He looked her up. Her mom was in the same house. He called Diane, and she was so understanding. They spoke several times, never in person, but long, comforting chats. She helped him through the divorce and the emotional upheaval ahead of him in May. He had one more thing he had to do. Columbine was a cathartic experience for much of the faculty. They reevaluated their lives. Many started over on new careers. By the spring of 2002, most of them had moved on. Every other administrator but Frank was gone. As May approached, Mr. D considered what had made him happiest. How did he really want to invest his remaining years? No compromises, he decided. He would follow his dream. He chose to remain principal at Columbine. He loved that job. Some of the families hated him. They were disgusted by his announcement. Others were pleased. His kids were ecstatic. Rohrbaugh was furious, but he was having success with the cops. His Hail Mary pass had broken the dam. Judge Jackson continued releasing evidence. Eventually, Jeffco was ordered to release almost everything, except the supposedly incendiary items, the killer's journals and the basement tapes. The motherlode came in November 2000, 11,000 pages of police reports, including virtually every witness account. Jeffco said that was everything. It was still hiding more than half. Reporters and families kept chipping away, demanding known items. Jeffco acted comically in its attempts to suppress. It numbered all the pages and then eliminated thousands, releasing the documents with numbered gaps. One release indicated nearly 3,000 missing pages. Jeffco was forced to cough up half a dozen more releases over the next year. In November 2001, officials described a huge stack as the last batch. More than 5,000 pages more came by the end of 2002 and 10,000 in 2003. In January, February, March, June, and three separate times in October. Halfway through all that, in April 2001, District Attorney Dave Thomas inadvertently mentioned the smoking gun, the affidavit to search Eric's house more than a year before the massacre. Jeffco had vigorously denied its existence for 2 years. Judge Jackson ordered it released. The affidavit was more damning than expected. Investigator Guerra had astutely pulled together the threads of Eric's early plotting and had documented mass murder threats and the bomb production to begin realizing them. The purpose of the cover-up was out in the open, yet it continued for several more years. Finally, in June 2003, the search warrant Kate Batten had composed on the afternoon of the massacre came out. It demonstrated conclusively that Jeffco officials had been lying about the Browns all along, that they knew about the warnings from the beginning, and the missing web pages were so accessible they'd found them in the first minutes of the attack. Anger and contempt kept rising. A federal judge finally had enough. He ruled that Jeffco could not be trusted even to warehouse valuable evidence. He ordered the county to hand over key material, such as the basement tapes, to be secured in the federal courthouse in Denver. Agent Fuselier beat Mr. D to retirement. 6 months after the massacre, the investigation was largely complete. Fuselier continued studying the killers, but he transitioned back to his role as head of domestic terrorism for the Colorado-Wyoming region. Few Americans had heard of Osama bin Laden, but a life-sized wanted poster of him greeted visitors to the FBI branch office. Fuselier saw enemy number one's picture every morning as he got off the elevator on the 18th floor. "He's a dangerous man," Fuselier told a visitor. The Bureau was determined to stop him. Fuselier also resumed training hostage negotiators and went back on call for serious incidents. 2 years later, he concluded one of the most notorious prison breaks in recent history. The Texas Seven had escaped the maximum security facility and embarked on a crime spree. The ringleader was serving 18 life sentences. He had nothing left to lose. On Christmas Eve 2000, they stole a cache of guns from a sporting goods store and ambushed a police officer. They shot him 11 times and ran him over on the way out to be sure he was dead. He was. A reward was posted, $500,000. The gang kept moving. On January 20, 2001, they were spotted in a trailer park near Colorado Springs. A SWAT team captured four of them, and a fifth killed himself to avoid recapture. The two holdouts barricaded themselves in a Holiday Inn. It took Agent Fuselier's team 5 hours to talk them out. They were fixated on corruption in the penal system, so Fuselier arranged a live interview on a local TV station at 2:30 a.m. A cameraman came inside the room so the holdouts could see they were actually broadcast live. Both convicts then surrendered and were sentenced to death. All six survivors await lethal injection in Texas. The stress wore Fuselier down. He would have 20 years at the Bureau that October and be eligible for his pension. He announced his retirement for that date. He would be 54. On September 11, 2001, the country was attacked. Bin Laden was behind it. Fuselier postponed his retirement and spent most of the next 11 months on the case. By the summer of 2002, the United States had taken over Afghanistan. Bin Laden had fled into hiding, and the urgency had abated. Fuselier's son, Brian, graduated from Columbine High that May, the last class Mr. D had been waiting for. Brian was leaving for college in July. Duane scheduled his retirement for the week afterward, so Brian wouldn't see his dad lazing about, jobless. "I could see a change the next day," Brian told his dad when he returned home for a visit. "You had mellowed out more than I had ever seen." Fuselier missed the work, though. Within months, he was consulting for the State Department. It sent him to conduct anti-terrorism training in third world countries. He spent a quarter of the year in sketchy sections of Pakistan, Tanzania, Malaysia, Macedonia, anywhere terrorists were active. Mimi worried. Dwayne didn't think about it much, and Brian didn't hear the tension return to his voice. Fear wasn't the problem at the FBI. It was the responsibility. It was getting harder going to work knowing someone's life might depend on me not making any mistakes that day, he said. Shortly before Brian left Columbine, Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine drew raves at Cannes. It became the top-grossing documentary in U.S. history. It wasn't really much about Columbine, and the title featured a minor myth that Eric and Dylan went bowling on April 20th. But it included a dramatic scene where Moore and a victim went to Kmart and asked to return the bullets still inside the guy. The stunt and/or publicity around it shamed Kmart into discontinuing ammunition sales nationwide. Marilyn Manson was interviewed in the film. Moore asked Manson what he would say to the killers if he had a chance to talk to them. I wouldn't say a single word to them, he said. I would listen to what they have to say, and that's what no one did. That was the story the media had told. The connection to KMFDM, the nihilistic band Eric did idolize and quote frequently, was ignored by the major media. Fans got word, however, and the band issued a statement of deep remorse. We are sick and appalled, as is the rest of the nation, by what took place in Colorado. None of us condone any Nazi beliefs whatsoever. The killer's parents remained silent. They never spoke to the press. Pastor Don Markshausen stayed close to Tom and Sue Klebold. He was a great comfort. Sue went back to training disabled students at the community college. That helped her cope. It's amazing how long it took me to get up and say my name at a meeting to say, I'm Dylan Klebold's mother, she said later. Dylan could have killed any number of the kids of people that I work with. Shopping could be intimidating. Anticipating that moment of recognition as a salesperson examined her credit card. It was a distinctive name. Sometimes they noticed. Boy, you're a survivor. One clerk said. Tom worked from home, so he had a choice about when to go out. He stayed in all the time. Pastor Don worried about him. Reverend Markshausen paid for that compassion. Much of his parish loved him for it. Others were outraged. The church council split. That was untenable. A year after the massacre, he was forced out. Markshausen had been one of the most revered ministers in the Denver area, but now he could not find a job. After a bout of unemployment, he left the state to head up a small parish. He missed Colorado and eventually moved back. He got a job as a chaplain at a county jail. His primary function was to advise inmates when loved ones had died. He was born for the job, ministering to the desperate. He empathized with each one, and it sucked the life out of him. The lawsuits sputtered on for years. They got messier. A rash of new defendants was added, including school officials, the killer's parents, the manufacturer of Luvox, and anyone who had come in contact with the guns. The suits were consolidated in federal court. Judge Lewis Babcock accepted the county's two major arguments, that it was not responsible for stopping the killers in advance, and that cops should not be punished for decisions under fire. Babcock said the authorities should have headed off the massacre months earlier, but were not legally bound. In November 2001, he dismissed most of the charges against the sheriff and the school. The families appealed, and the county settled the next year. $15,000 each, a fraction of their legal fees. The discovery process never brought much to light. It didn't need to. The Rohrbaugh's initial offensive had set the legal process in motion, and it continued under its own power. Judge Babcock refused to dismiss the Sanders case. He balked at the contention that Dave's rescue involved split-second decisions. They had time in the third hour, Babcock boomed. The cops had hundreds of people to rescue. Their attorney responded. They'd had to allocate resources. More than 750 cops had been on the scene, the judge reminded him. It's not as though they were a little shorthanded out there that day, he said. In August 2002, Jeffco paid Angela Sanders $1.5 million. It admitted to no wrongdoing. The last Jeffco case to close was Patrick Ireland's. He got $117,500. After years of wrangling, most of the fringe cases were dismissed. Luvox was pulled from the market. That left the killers' families. They wanted to settle. They didn't have a lot of money, but they had insurance. It turned out their homeowners' policies covered murder by their children. About $1.6 million was divided between 31 families. Most of it came from the Klebold's policy. Similar agreements were reached with Mark Maines, Philip Duran, and Robin Anderson for an estimated total of approximately $1.3 million. Five families rebuffed the Harrises and Klebolds, no buyout without information. It wasn't really about the money for the Rohrbachs and four others. They were battling for information, and they proved it. But they were caught in a stalemate. The killer's parents would talk if the victims dropped the lawsuits. The victims would drop the lawsuits if the parents spoke. For two more years, it continued. Then the judge brokered a deal. The holdouts would dismiss their suits if the killer's parents answered all their questions, privately, but under oath. It was a bitter compromise. The holdouts wanted answers for the public as well as themselves. They settled for themselves. In July 2003, the four parents were deposed for several days. Media came to photograph them. They had remained so private that few reporters even knew what they looked like. 2 weeks after the depositions, an agreement was announced. It appeared to be over. But Dawn Anna called for the depositions to be made public, understanding the warning signs could prevent the next Columbine. A chorus gathered behind her. A magistrate ruled that the transcripts would be destroyed per the agreement. That set off a public outcry and a wave of open records requests. Judge Babcock agreed to consider arguments. It had taken 4 years to reach this point. They were only halfway there. In April 2007, Judge Babcock finally ruled. There is a legitimate public interest in these materials so that similar tragedies may hopefully be prevented, he wrote. I conclude, however, that the balance of interests still strikes in favor of maintaining strict confidentiality. He settled on a compromise. The transcripts would be sealed at the National Archives for 20 years. The truth would come out in 2027, 28 years after the massacre. Though he was retired, Fuselier hoped to see the depositions too. Optimally, he would like to question the parents himself. He knew where the boys ended, psychologically, but their origins were a mystery, particularly Eric's. Only two people had an 18-year perspective on his path to psychopathy. When did Eric start exhibiting the early hallmarks, and how were they visible? Wayne had adopted a stern parenting style. How had that worked? Eric wrote little about interaction with his mother. What had Kathy's approach been? Were there any successes? Anything that could help the next parent? Fuselier understood their refusal to talk. I have the utmost sympathy for the Harris and Klebold parents, he said. They have been vilified without information. No one has sufficient objective information to draw any conclusions. Fuselier said he had raised two sons, and either one could have emerged with traits beyond his comprehension. Eric documented his parents' frustration with his behavior, as well as their attempts to force him to conform. Their tactics might have been all wrong for a budding young psychopath, but how do parents even know what that is? I believe they have been unjustifiably criticized for what their sons did, Fuselier said. They are probably asking themselves the same questions that we in the profession are asking. Patrick Ireland left home for Colorado State in fall 2000. He did fine. He really took to campus life, and he was surprised by how much he enjoyed business school. Letting go of architecture turned out to be easy. He had been forced into something he liked more. He still fought memory battles, struggled a bit to find words, and would probably remain on anti-seizure medication for life. He met a girl his first night, Casey Lancaster. She was clever, attractive, and a little shy. They clicked immediately and became close friends. In May 2004, he graduated magna cum laude. Armed with a B.S. in business administration, he accepted a job as a financial planner at Northwestern Mutual Financial Network. He loved it. One finger troubled him a little. His right pinky jutted out away from the others, which caused a minor issue when he shook hands. It could poke the other person in the palm a little, just enough to signal that something was off. You could catch him glancing down there nervously if you knew what to look for. It was not the first impression he wanted to make, but he had such a commanding presence once he spoke. Clients trusted him. His bosses were happy. He was becoming a star. Patrick had retired the wheelchair and the crutch in high school. The foot brace remained. His right leg lagged behind a little, noticeable but not debilitating. Running was out of the question, but water skis were not. Balance, strength, and agility were all hurdles Patrick could overcome, but he would never regain the dexterity in his right foot to grip the ski. So he worked with an engineering friend to build a custom boot he could slip on as he tried to rise up on the water. They spent months working on prototypes and experimenting with them at the lake. John went with them for encouragement. Every time, the boat dragged Patrick uselessly behind. They tried stripping the shell off a rollerblade and adhering it to the ski. Nope. They refined it and returned to the lake. Useless. Patrick tried over and over. He had made about 10 runs that evening, and it was getting late. John was sure Patrick was exhausted and thought it was time to break. "No, I can do this," Patrick said. John agreed. He sat in the passenger seat facing backward. The driver throttled the engine, and John watched his boy rise up onto the surface of the lake. Wow. Patrick felt the spray belt his face. The sun danced on the waves. The tow rope jerked his arms. He dug in for a turn. A sheet of water shot up and sliced into his calf. It hurt, just a little. Ah, the pain of competition. It felt great. Everyone expected copycats. The country braced for a new level of horror. School shooting deaths actually dropped 25% over the next 3 years. But Eric and Dylan gave young eyes a fresh approach, terrorist tactics for personal aggrandizement. In 2001, a pair of ninth graders at a Fort Collins, Colorado middle school procured a similar arsenal, Tech 9, shotgun, rifles, and propane bombs. They planned to reverse Eric's chronology, seal off exits, mow down students, and save the bombs for stragglers. They would finish by taking 10 hostages, holding them in the counseling office for fun, then killing the kids and themselves. But they leaked. Kids nearly always leak. The bigger the plot, the wider the leakage. The Fort Collins pair went recruiting for gunmen to cover all the exits. One of the plotters told at least 7 people that he planned to redo Columbine. He bragged to 4 girls that they would be the first to die. They went straight to the police. Teen peers were different after 1999. Jokes scared the crap out of kids. 2 more grandiose plots in Malcolm, Nebraska and Oakland, New Jersey were foiled in the first 5 years. School administrators around the country responded with zero tolerance, meaning every idle threat was treated like a cocked gun. That drove everyone crazy. Nearly all supposed killers turned out to be kids blowing off steam. It wasn't working for anyone. A pair of government how-to guides helped. The FBI and the Secret Service each published reports in the first 3 years, guiding faculty to identify serious threats. The central recommendations contradicted prevailing post-Columbine behavior. They said identifying outcasts as threats is not healthy. It demonizes innocent kids who are already struggling. It is also unproductive. Oddballs are not the problem. They do not fit the profile. There is no profile. All the recent school shooters shared exactly one trait, 100% male. Since the study, a few have been female. Aside from personal experience, no other characteristic hit 50%, not even close. There is no accurate or useful profile of attackers, the Secret Service said. Attackers came from all ethnic, economic, and social classes. The bulk came from solid two-parent homes. Most had no criminal record or history of violence. The two biggest myths were that shooters were loners and that they snapped. A staggering 93% planned their attack in advance. The path toward violence is an evolutionary one, with signposts along the way, the FBI report said. Cultural influences also appeared weak. Only a quarter were interested in violent movies, half that number in video games, probably below average for teen boys. Most perps shared a crucial experience. 98% had suffered a loss or failure they perceived as serious. Anything from getting fired to blowing a test or getting dumped. Of course, everyone suffers loss and failure, but for these kids, the trauma seemed to set anger in motion. This was certainly true in Columbine. Dylan viewed his entire life as failure, and Eric's arrest accelerated his anger. So what should adults look for? First and foremost, advance confessions. 81% of shooters had confided their intentions. More than half told at least two people. Most threats are idle, though. The key is specificity. Vague, implied, and implausible threats are low risk. The danger skyrockets when threats are direct and specific. Identify a motive and indicate work performed to carry it out. Melodramatic outbursts do not increase the risk. A subtler form of leakage is preoccupation with death, destruction, and violence. A graphic mutilation story might be an early warning sign, or a vivid imagination. Add malice, brutality, and an unrepentant hero, and concern should rise. Don't overreact to a single story or drawing, the FBI warned. Normal teen boys enjoy violence and are fascinated with the macabre. Writings and drawings on these themes can be a reflection of a harmless but rich and creative fantasy life, the report said. The key was repetition leading to obsession. The Bureau described a boy who'd worked guns and violence into every assignment. In home ec class, he'd baked a cake in the shape of a gun. The FBI compiled a specific list of warning signs, including symptoms of both psychopathy and depression. Manipulation, intolerance, superiority, narcissism, alienation, rigidity, lethargy, dehumanization of others, and externalizing blame. It was a daunting list. That's a small excerpt. Few teachers were going to master it. The FBI recommended against trying. It suggested one person per school be trained intensely for all faculty and administrators to turn to. The FBI added one final caution. A kid matching most of its warning signs was more likely to be suffering from depression or mental illness than planning an attack. Most kids matching the criteria needed help, not incarceration. Columbine also changed police response to attacks. No more perimeters. A national task force was organized to develop a new plan. In 2003, it released the Active Shooter Protocol. The gist was simple. If the shooter seems active, storm the building. Move toward the sound of gunfire. Disregard even victims. There is one objective. Neutralize the shooters. Stop them or kill them. The concept had been around for years, but had been rejected. Pre-Columbine, cops had been exhorted to proceed cautiously, secure the perimeter, get the gunman talking, wait for the SWAT team. The key to the new protocol was active. Most shootings, the vast majority, were labeled passive. The gunman was alive, but not firing. Those cases reverted to the old protocol. Success depended on accurately determining the threat in the first moments. Officers face a second decision point when they reach the shooters. If the killer is holed up in a classroom, holding kids but not firing, responders may need to stop there and use traditional hostage techniques. Storming the classroom could provoke the gunman, but if the shooter is firing, even just periodically, move in. The active shooter protocol gained quick and widespread acceptance. In a series of shootings over the next decade, including the worst disaster at Virginia Tech, cops or guards rushed in, stopped shooters, and saved lives. Sue Patron asked for and received the two sidewalk blocks her son Danny died on. They were jackhammered out of the ground and installed in her backyard, in the shadow of a fragrant spruce tree. Around the slab, she created a rock garden, with two big wooden tubs overflowing with petunias. She had a sturdy oak truss constructed over the slab and a porch swing suspended from the crossbeam. She and Rich and their shaggy little dog can nestle comfortably into the generous swing. Linda Sanders kept the Advil tablet found near Dave's body. He had trouble with knee swelling, so he always carried one in his pocket. Just one. She took his bloody clothes, a swath of carpet from under his head, a little fragment of tooth that chipped off when he fell, and his glasses. She would never let those glasses go. She snapped them into an eyeglass case and placed them on the nightstand by her bed. She intends to leave them that way forever. The lawsuit on behalf of Dave Sanders outlived all the others, but his widow chose not to take part. She was not angry at the police, or the school, or the parents. She was angry at her situation. She was lonely. 50. The Basement Tapes. Eric wanted to be remembered. He spent a year on the Book of God, but 5 weeks before Judgment Day, he decided that wasn't good enough. He wanted a starring role on camera, so on March 15th, he and Dylan began The Basement Tapes. It would be a tight shooting schedule, with no time for editing or post-production. They filmed with a Sony 8mm camcorder, checked out from the Columbine High Video Lab. The first installment was a basic talk show setup, a stationary camera in the family room in Eric's basement, outside his bedroom. He continued making camera adjustments after he was rolling, perhaps as a sneaky way to ensure his audience would be clear on the director. The video project was entirely about his audience. Ultimately, the attack was, too. Eric joined Dylan on set. They kicked back in plush velvet recliners, bantering about the big event. Eric had a bottle of Jack Daniels in one hand and Arlene laid across his lap. He took a swig and tried not to grimace. He hated the stuff. Dylan munched on a toothpick and took little sips of Jack as well. They ranted for more than an hour. Dylan was wild and animated and angry, obsessively hurling his fingers through his long, ratty hair. Eric was mostly calm and controlled. They spoke with one voice, Eric's. Eric introduced most ideas. Dylan riffed along. They insulted the usual inferiors, blacks, Latinos, gays, and women. "Yes, moms, stay home," Eric said. "Fucking make me dinner, bitch." Sometimes Eric got kind of loud. That made Dylan nervous. It was after 1 a.m., and Eric's parents were upstairs, snoozing away. "Careful," Dylan warned. They rattled off a list of kids who'd pissed them off. Eric had been dragged across the country, the scrawny little white guy, constantly starting over, always at the bottom of the food chain. People kept making fun of him. "My face, my hair, my shirts." He enumerated every girl who had refused his advances. Dylan got fired up just listening. He faced the camera and addressed his tormentors. "If you could see all the anger I've stored over the past 4 fucking years, he said. He described a sophomore who didn't deserve the jaw evolution gave him. "Look for his jaw," Dylan said. "It won't be on his body." Eric named one guy he planned to shoot in the balls, another in the face. "I imagine I will be shot in the head by a fucking cop," he said. That failed, too. A minute or two later, at 12:06, the first SWAT team finally entered Columbine High School, on the opposite end of the building. Eric and Dylan could not have known. They apparently waited for their cars to explode, weathered a final disappointment, and then called it a day. Eric turned his back on the mess. He retreated to the southwest corner, one of the few unspoiled areas in the room. Dylan joined him there. It was a cozy spot near the windows, nestled between walls and bookshelves on three sides, with a mountain view. One body lay nearby. It was Patrick Ireland, gently breathing, unconscious. The boys sat down on the floor, facing out at the windows. They seemed to be staying low to avoid police fire. That may seem odd, given their intentions, but it's all about control. Eric propped himself against a bookshelf, just a shoulder width to the right of Dylan and a few feet behind, watching his back. One of them lit the rag used as a fuse on a Molotov cocktail. He set it on the table right above Patrick. Eric raised the shotgun barrel to his mouth, like the anti-hero of the downward spiral. Dylan pointed the Tech-9 at his left temple. The Molotov rag burned down. Eric fired through the roof of his mouth, causing evacuation of the brain. He collapsed against the books, and his torso slumped to the side. He ended that way, with his arms curled forward as if hugging an invisible pillow. Dylan's blast knocked him flat on his back and strewed brain matter across Eric's left knee. Dylan's head came to rest just beside it. A lot of blood spilled, but less than their victims. Eric and Dylan blew out their medullas, the brain center that controls involuntary functions. Their hearts stopped almost instantly. Medically, bleeding ceased. Gravity took over, and they leaked. Dylan's blood soaked into Eric's pant leg. The Molotov blew. It started a small fire. It also spilled Eric's crude napalm over the tabletop and sealed the lump of his brain underneath. That detail would prove the boys died just before the eruption. The alarm system detected the fire and recorded the time as 12:08. The sprinklers put it out and drenched the boys. Blood drained from their skulls and oxidized like blackened halos. 3 hours later, police found Eric crumpled, Dylan sprawled leisurely. His legs flopped over to the side, one knee atop the other, ankles crossed. One arm draped across his stomach, underlining the word emblazoned on his black t-shirt. His head lay back, mouth open, jaw slack. Blood trickled out the corners toward his ears. He looked serene. The red letters on his chest screamed, "Wrath." 53. At the Broken Places. It took 8.5 years to erect the permanent memorial. In 2006, the fund hit 70% of its reduced budget, permitting construction to begin. An event was planned for the groundbreaking in June, to honor the dead and to publicize the $300,000 outstanding. Bill Clinton flew in. 2,000 mourners turned out. Dawn Anna read the 13 names. "We're here because we love them," she said. "We're here as a family and as a community that's been through the darkest of days and is coming through to the light." Thunderheads rolled in and opened up on the crowd. Scattered umbrellas popped up, but most people were caught unaware. Nobody moved. They didn't care. This was Republican country, but Clinton's introduction drew wild applause. These people were proud to host an American president. "I am here today because millions of Americans were changed by Columbine," he said. "It was one of the darkest days Hillary and I had in the White House. We wept. We prayed." Right before his appearance, she'd called from the Senate, he said, "just to remind me of what we did that day." This was a momentous event in the history of the country, and every parent was left feeling helpless, even the president. He had watched the survivors evolve, Clinton said. He compared them to his colleague, Max Cleland, who'd left both legs and one arm in Vietnam. It was a struggle for Max to dress every morning. He could have resented the thousands who came back unscathed or who'd avoided the draft, like him, Clinton said. What a waste that would be. Cleland ran for the Senate and represented Georgia for 6 years. He was fond of quoting Ernest Hemingway, and Clinton recited his favorite passage. The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places. Every day, from now on, the world will break someone, Clinton added. These magnificent families, in memory of their children and their teacher, can help them always to be strong. Patrick Ireland proposed to Casey, the girl he'd met his first night at CSU. They would never have met, he pointed out, if he had not been shot. They married on an August afternoon. Six bridesmaids in rose-red gowns walked the aisle of an ornate Catholic church. Mr. D came. He was struck by the sight of Patrick standing at the altar with no physical support. He was also taken aback by the number of classmates involved. It was a familiar pattern. For 20 years, he had watched alumni drift away from their high school buds, but the 2,000 survivors stuck close. Patrick walked out gracefully and composed. Mr. D wiped off a tear. Patrick's doctor from Craig was there, still incredulous. So was Laura, the girl Patrick had been afraid to ask to prom. The wedding party took a month of ballroom dance lessons to prepare for the reception. Patrick spun Casey across the floor. They waltzed and two-stepped and did the foxtrot. They closed out the first dance with a deep dip. Patrick joined his mother for Because You Loved Me. Diane Warren wrote the song to her father for encouraging her when no one else believed. Kathy teared up quietly in her son's arms. Former agent Dwayne Fuselier was still being asked to address law enforcement groups and teachers' conventions. They still wanted to know why. Fuselier kept agreeing to speak, insisting each presentation would be the last. He continues to teach hostage negotiators in the Third World. He finds a lot more time for golf, and his mind wanders occasionally to Eric and Dylan, with no satisfaction, because the ending never changes. Both his sons graduated from college and launched successful careers. He still hopes to interview Eric and Dylan's parents. Brad and Misty Bernal resettled nearby in New Mexico. They are much happier there. She Said Yes was reissued in two paperback formats, a library edition and an audiobook. It has sold over 1 million copies. The web is loaded with sites unabashedly recounting the myth. Cassie's youth pastor was right. The church stuck with the story. Local churches felt a surge following Columbine. Attendance spiked. Fervor was unprecedented. It faded. Pastors reported no long-term impact. The Harrises and Klebolds remained secluded. The Harrises eventually sold their house, but remained in the area. The Klebolds have not moved. In July of 2006, Dylan's older brother, Byron, got married. Kids at Columbine stopped using the word as the name of a massacre. It became just a high school again. Smokers returned to chatting up adult strangers who strolled through Clement Park near their pit. It did not occur to them to be afraid. When a journalist stopped by to assess the return to normalcy, they were puzzled. Why would anyone be interested in their boring school? They really didn't know. Their faces lit up when they discovered he was from the city. What were the clubs like? Had he been to Colfax Avenue? Were there really strip clubs and winos and hookers there? Of course, they remembered the tragedy. What an awful day. Their grade schools were locked down. Everyone was scared. Several had had older siblings trapped in the high school. Their parents had been upset for months. So what was Denver like? Mr. D had two grandchildren. His son settled into a career, and his daughter got engaged. Frank didn't let Diane Meyer get away the second time. After his divorce, they reunited in person. She was just as funny as in high school. Same blue eyes, same insightful mind and selflessness. Someone to lean on, Frank said. They began dating again. On Christmas Eve 2003, Frank asked her to marry him. She said yes. They remain engaged. Mr. D informed his students he planned to retire. He will stay through graduation in 2012 or 2013. He will be 57 or 58. He's not sure what he'll do then. Golf, travel, enjoy. Linda Sanders pulled out of her depression. She still has rough days, but not so often. By 2008, she was dating again. The memorial felt like the final step. One last controversy marred its completion. In the spring of 2007, as bulldozers carved out the site on the back slope of Rebel Hill, Brian Rohrbaugh went to battle with the memorial committee. An inner ring of remembrance honored the 13 in a special way. The larger ring of healing that surrounded it would bear quotes from students, teachers, friends, neighbors. Everyone touched by the tragedy, whether or not a bullet actually pierced their skin. Each of the 13 families was allocated a space on the inner ring for a large inscription in the brown marble to remember their child, father, or spouse. They were asked to keep it tasteful and respectful. 12 and a half families agreed. Sue Patrone and Brian Rohrbaugh submitted separate inscriptions for Danny to be run side by side. Sue described her boy's blue eyes, engaging smile, and infectious laugh. Brian submitted an angry rant, blaming Columbine on a godless school system in a nation that legalized abortion, where authorities lied and covered up their crimes. He ended with a biblical quote, declaring, "There is no peace for the wicked." The committee asked Brian to tone it down. He refused. Both sides agreed to keep the wording confidential, but the gist of the dispute leaked. It caused yet another firestorm in Colorado. The public was split. A standoff ensued. Nobody wanted an angry tirade inside the ring of remembrance. The committee had the power to stop it. Brian dared them to do it. It was no contest. Even after 8 years, nothing trumped a grieving dad. The Columbine Memorial was dedicated on a sunny afternoon in September 2007. A few thousand visitors filed quietly past the inner wall. There was no ruckus over the angry inscription. It did not draw more onlookers than the other 12, even out of curiosity. There was no discernible reaction. No one seemed to care. Patrick Arland spoke on behalf of the injured. "The shootings were an event that occurred," he said, "but it did not define me as a person. It did not set the tone for the rest of my life." 13 doves were released. Seconds later, 200 more fluttered free, an arbitrary number to signify everyone else. They scattered up in all directions. For a moment, they seemed to fill the entire sky. Then they found one another and coalesced into a single flock, a massive white cloud weaving from left to right and back again against the clear blue sky. This concludes the reading of Columbine by Dave Cullen. Copyright 2009 by Dave Cullen. This book was read by Don Leslie and directed by Emily Janice Card. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Grand Central Publishing and was produced by Skyboat Road Company, Inc. in 2009 for Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.